sake, don't make such a big deal of it.
No reply. The dog overtook her on the stairs and looked down at her from the top step with his tongue hanging out.
Darius!
By that stupid dog Slobber, where was he? His room was right next to the one Mortimer had used as an office. The door was open, and so was his suitcase, lying on the bed. It was the case she had bought him for their first trip together. Buying books with Darius had always been a pleasure, and she had to admit that he'd kept her from making many silly mistakes.
What?
How heavy her sharp tongue suddenly felt.
What the devil are you doing?
Well, what did she think? Very obviously, he was packing the few clothes he possessed.
Darius!
He put the drawing of Meggie that Risa had given him onto the bed, with the notebook Mortimer had bound for him, and the bookmark that Meggie had made him from a blue jay's feathers. The bathrobe, he said hesitantly, as he put the photograph of his parents, the one that always stood by his bed, in the case. Do you mind if I take it with me?
Don't ask such silly questions, of course not! It was a present, for heaven's sake. But where are you going?
Cerberus trotted into the room and went to the bedside cupboard. Darius always kept a few dog biscuits in the drawer. I don't know yet. He folded the bathrobe just as carefully as its other clothes. It was much too large for him, but how would she have known his size? Put the drawing, the notebook, and the bookmark in the case, and closed it. Of course, he couldn't manage to close the catches. He was so clumsy sometimes.
Unpack that again, at once. This is silly.
But Darius shook his head.
Heavens above! You can't go as well and leave me all alone!
Eleanor herself was frightened by the despair in her voice. You're alone even when I'm here, Eleanor, said Darius in a strained voice. You're so unhappy. I can't stand it any more. The stupid dog gave up snuffling around the bedside table and stood in front of her looking sad. He's right, said his watering doggy eyes. As if she didn't know. She couldn't stand herself any more either. Had she been like this long ago, before Meggie, Mortimer, and Risa came to live with her? Maybe. But then, there'd only been the books around, and they weren't complaining. Although, to be honest, she'd never been as hard on the books as she was on Darius.
All right, you go then.
Her voice began shaking in the most ridiculous way.
Leave me alone. You're right. Why would you want to watch me getting more insufferable every day? Always waiting for some miracle to bring them back? Perhaps I ought to shoot myself or drown myself in the lake instead of perishing slowly in this miserable way. Writers sometimes do that, and it sounds good in stories.
Oh, the way he was looking at her with his far-sighted eyes. She really ought to have bought him new glasses long ago. His present pair looked just too silly. Then he opened the case again and stared at his possessions. He took out Meggie's bookmark and stroked the boldly patterned blue feathers. Blue jay feathers. Meggie had glued them to a strip of pale yellow cardboard. It looked very pretty. Darius cleared his throat. He cleared it 3 times. Oh, very well, he said at last, in a voice that he carefully kept level. You win, Eleanor. I'll try it. Fetch me that sheet of paper, or you probably will go and shoot yourself some day.
What? What was he saying?
Eleanor's heart began to race, as if hurrying on ahead of her into the inkwell to see the fairies, the glassmen, and the people she loved so much more than she loved any book.
You mean?
Darius nodded, resigned, like a warrior who has fought too many battles. Yes, he said. Yes, Eleanor.
I'll get it!
Eleanor turned on her heel. Everything that had made her heart so heavy these last few weeks, turning her limbs to an old woman's, it was all gone, vanished without trace. But Darius called her back.
Eleanor, we ought to take some of Meggie's notebooks, too, and some practical things, like a lighter, for instance. And a knife,
Eleanor added. After all, Buster was where they were going, and she had sworn that when next she met him, she'd have a knife in her own hand. She almost fell down the stairs. She was in such a hurry to get back to the library. Cerberus bounded after her, panting with excitement. Did he guess, in some corner of his doggy heart, that they were following his old master to the place where he'd gone when he had disappeared.
He's going to try it. He's going to try it.
Eleanor couldn't think of anything else. She didn't think of Risa's lost voice, Cockerel's stiff leg, or Flatnose's mutilated face.
Everything's going to be all right,
was all she thought, as with trembling fingers she took the words that Orpheus had written out of the glass case. This time there won't be any Capricorn to frighten Darius. This time he'll read beautifully.
Oh, dear God, Eleanor, you're going to see them again.
Chapter 22. Taking the Bait. A dwarf about twice the size of a glass man. Definitely not furry like Tullio. No, the dwarf was to have skin as white as alabaster, a head too big for it, and bandy legs. At least the milksop always knew just what he wanted, even if his orders had come noticeably less often since the piper arrived in the city. Orpheus was just wondering whether to give the dwarf red hair or the white hair of an albino when Os knocked and, at his master's grunt of "Enter," put his head around the door. Os had revolting table manners and was not much given to washing himself, but he never forgot to knock.
"There's another letter for you, my lord."
Ah, how good it made him feel being called that, "my lord." Os came in, bowed his bald head, he sometimes overdid the civility, and handed Orpheus a sealed piece of paper. Paper? That was strange. The fine gentlemen usually sent their orders written on parchment, and the seal didn't look familiar either. Well, never mind that. This would be the third order today. Business was good. The piper's arrival had made no difference to that. This world could have been made for him. Hadn't he always known it, ever since he first opened Fenolio's book with his sweaty schoolboy fingers? His accomplished lies didn't get him jailed as a forger or con man here. They valued his talents at their true worth in this world, and all Umbra bowed to him when he crossed the marketplace in his fine clothes. Fabulous. "Who's the letter from?" Os shrugged his ridiculously broad shoulders.
"Dunno, my lord. Farid gave it to me."
"Farid?" Orpheus sat up straight. "Why didn't you say so at once?" He quickly snatched the letter from Os's clumsy fingers. "Orpheus." Of course, he didn't begin, "Dear Orpheus." Even in the salutation of a letter, the blue jay told no lies. "Farid has told me what you want in return for the words my wife has asked you for. I agree." Orpheus read the words three times, four, five times, and yes, there it was, in black and white. "I agree." The bookbinder had taken the bait. Could it really be that easy? Yes, why not? Heroes are fools. Hadn't he always said so? The blue jay had fallen into the trap, and all he had to do was snap it shut with a pen, some ink, and his tongue. "Go away! I want to be alone!" he snarled at Os, who was standing there looking bored and throwing nuts at the two glassmen. "And take Jasper with you!" Orpheus liked talking to himself out loud when he was writing down his ideas, so the glassman had better be out of the room. Jasper sat on Farid's shoulder far too often, and on no account must the boy learn what Orpheus was planning to write now. It was true that the stupid boy wanted Dustfinger back even more fervently than he did, but Orpheus wasn't so sure that he would sacrifice his girlfriend's father in return. No, by now Farid worshipped the blue jay as much as everyone else here did. Ironstone gave his brother a gleefully malicious glance as Os picked up Jasper from the desk with fleshy fingers. "Parchment," Orpheus ordered as soon as the door had closed behind the two of them, and Ironstone busily spread the best sheet they had on the desk. Orpheus, however, went to the window and looked out at the hills, from which presumably the blue jay's letter had come. Silvertongue, blue jay, fine names they'd given him, and yes, Mortimer was certainly very much braver and more noble than Orpheus himself was, but such a paragon couldn't compete with him in cunning. The good are stupid. "You have his wife to thank for this, Orpheus," he told himself as he began pacing up and down. Nothing helped him think better. If his wife wasn't so afraid of losing him, you might never have found the bait you need. Oh, it would be fantastic. His greatest triumph. Unicorns, dwarves, rainbow-colored fairies. Not bad at all, but nothing compared to what he'd do now. He would bring the Fire Dancer back from the dead. Orpheus. Had the name he had taken ever suited him better? But he would be wilier than the singer whose name he had stolen. He would indeed. He would send another man into the realm of death in the Fire Dancer's place. And he'd make sure that he didn't come back. Do you hear me, Dustfinger, in the cold land where you are now? Whispered Orpheus, while Ironstone busily stirred the ink. I've caught the bait to buy your freedom, the most wonderful bait of all, decked out with the finest pale blue feathers. He began humming, as he always did when he was pleased with himself, and picked up Mortimer's letter again. What else had the Blue Jay written? It will be as you require. By the devil's cloven hoof, he was writing in the style of public proclamations, like the robbers of the old days. I will try to call up the white women, and in return, you will write words to take my wife and daughter back to Eleanor's house. But all you are to say about me is that I will follow them later. Well, well, what was this? Surprised, Orpheus lowered the sheet of paper. Mortimer wanted to stay. Why? Because his noble and heroic heart wouldn't let him steal away now that the piper had made his threat? Or did he just like playing the part of a robber too much? Well, never mind which, noble Blue Jay, said Orpheus softly. Ooh, how he liked the sound of his own voice. It won't turn out the way you think it will, because I have plans of my own for you. High-minded idiot! Hadn't Mortimer ever read any tale of robbers right through? No happy ending for Robin Hood, for Angelo Duca, for Dick Turpin, and all the rest of them. Why would there be a happy ending for the Blue Jay? No, he was going to play just one part. The bait on the hook, a tasty bait, and one condemned to certain death. And I will write the last song about him, thought Orpheus, as he strode up and down with a spring in his step, as if he already felt the right words inside him all the way down to his toes. Good people, hear the amazing tale of the Blue Jay, who brought the Fire Dancer back from the dead, but then, sad to say, lost his own life. Heart-rending, like Robin Hood's death at the hands of the treacherous nun, or Angelo Duca's end on the gallows beside his dead friend, with the hangman riding him to death on his shoulders. Yes, every hero needs a death like that. Even Fenolio wouldn't write it any other way. Ah, but he hadn't finished reading the letter yet. What else did that most noble of robbers have to say? Hang a piece of blue cloth in the window when you have written the words. How romantic, a real robber's idea. He really did seem to be turning more and more into the character made by Fenolio in his image. I will meet you at the graveyard of the strolling players on the following night. Farid knows where it is. Come alone, bringing one servant at the most. I know you are on friendly terms with the new governor, and I will not show myself until I am certain that none of his men is with you. Mortimer. Well, well. So he actually still signed his old name. Who did he think he was fooling? Come alone. Oh, yes, I'll come alone, thought Orpheus, and you won't be able to see the words I've sent on ahead of you. He rolled up the letter and slid it under his desk. Everything ready, Ironstone? A dozen sharpened pens, ink stirred slowly while you take 65 breaths, a sheet of the best parchment? A dozen pens, 65 breaths, the very best parchment. What about this list of words? Orpheus looked at his bitten fingernails. He had recently taken to bathing them in rose water every morning, but unfortunately, that just made them tastier. Your useless brother left his footprints all over the words beginning with B. The list. The list of all the words used by Fenolio in Inkheart, arranged in alphabetical order. He had only recently told Jasper to prepare it. His brother had terrible handwriting. But unfortunately, the glass man had only just reached the letter D, so Orpheus still had to look everything up in Fenolio's book if he wanted to be sure that any words he used were in Inkart too. It was a nuisance, but it had to be done, and so far, his method had proved its merits. All ready? Ironstone nodded eagerly. Good. The words were already coming. Orpheus sensed them like a tingling of his scalp. As soon as he picked up the pen, he could hardly dip it in the ink fast enough. Dustfinger. The tears still came to his eyes when he remembered seeing him lying dead in the mine. Certainly one of the worst moments of his life. And how the promise he'd given Roxanne had come to haunt him, even if she had never believed a word of it. He had given it with the dead man at his feet. I'll find words as precious and intoxicating as the scent of a lily. Words to beguile death and open the cold fingers he has closed around Dustfinger's warm heart. He had been looking for those words ever since he arrived in this world. Even if Farid and Fenolio thought he did nothing but write unicorns and rainbow-colored fairies into it. But after his first failed attempts, he had accepted the bitter fact that beauty of sound alone was not enough in this case. Words like lilies would never bring Dustfinger back. Death demanded a more substantial price, a price paid in flesh and blood. Incredible that he hadn't hit upon the idea of Mortimer before. The man who had made death a laughingstock to the living when he had bound an empty book to make the Adderhead immortal. So, away with him. This world needed only one silver tongue, and it was his. Once he had fed Mortimer to death, and Fenolio's brain was wrecked by the drink, only he would go on telling the story, on and on, with a suitable part in it for Dustfinger, and a not inconsiderable part for himself. Yes, call up the white women for me, Mortimer, whispered Orpheus as he filled the parchment with word after word in his elegant script. You'll never know what I've whispered into their pale ears first. Look what I've brought you, the blue jay. Take him to your cold lord with greetings from Orpheus, and give me the fire dancer in exchange. Ah, Orpheus, Orpheus, they can say many things about you, but they can never call you stupid. He dipped his pen in the ink with a soft laugh, and spun around when the door opened behind him. Farid came in. Damn it, where was Os? What do you want? He snapped at the boy. How often do I have to tell you to knock before coming in? Next time I'll throw the inkwell at your stupid head. Bring me wine, the best we have. How the lad looked at him as he closed the door. He hates me, thought Orpheus. He liked that idea. In his experience, only the powerful were hated, and that was what he meant to be in this world. Powerful. Chapter 23. The Graveyard of the Strolling Players. The Strolling Players' graveyard lay above a deserted village, Carandrella. It had kept its name, although the inhabitants had left long ago. Why and where they went, no one knew now. An epidemic, some said, while others spoke of famine, and others again of two warring clans who had slaughtered each other and driven out any survivors. Whichever story was true, it wasn't in Fenolio's book, nor was this graveyard where the peasants had buried their dead among the motley folk, so that now they slept side by side forever. A narrow, stony path wound its way from the abandoned cottages up the furze-grown slope and ended on a rocky headland. Standing there, you could look far south over the treetops of the Wayless Wood toward Argenta, where the sea lay somewhere beyond the hills. The dead of Carandrella, they said in Lombrica, had the best view in the country. A crumbling wall surrounded the graves. The gravestones were of the pale stone that was also used to build houses here. Stones for the living, stones for the dead. Names were incised on some of them, scratched clumsily, as if whoever wrote them had learned the letters only to preserve the sound of a beloved name, rescuing it from the silence of death. Maggie felt as if the stones were whispering those names to her as she walked past the graves. Farina, Rosa, Lucio, Renzo. Those stones that bore no names seemed like closed mouths, sad mouths that had forgotten how to speak. but perhaps the dead didn't mind what their names had once been. Mo was still talking to Orpheus. The strong man was sizing up his bodyguard, Os, as if wondering which of them had the broader chest.
Mo, don't do it, please.
Maggie looked at her mother and abruptly turned her face away when Risa returned her glance. She was so angry with her. It was all because of Risa's tears and because she had ridden off to see Orpheus that Mo was here now. The Black Prince had come with them as well as the strong man, and Doria, although his brother had told him to stay behind. Like Maggie, he was standing among the graves, looking around him at the things lying in front of the gravestones. Faded flowers, a wooden toy, a shoe, a whistle. A fresh flower lay on one grave. Doria picked it up. The flower was white, like the beings they were waiting for. When he saw Maggie looking at him, he came over to her. He really wasn't at all like his brother. The strong man wore his brown hair short, but Doria's was wavy and shoulder length. Sometimes, Maggie felt as if he had come out of one of the old fairy tale books that Mo had given her when she'd just learned to read. The pictures in the books had been yellow with age, but Maggie used to look at them for hours, firmly convinced that the fairies featured in some of the tales had painted them with their tiny hands.
"Can you read the letters on the stones?"
Doria was still holding the white flower as he stopped in front of her. Two fingers of his left hand were stiff. His father had broken them long ago in a drunken rage when Doria tried to protect his sister from him. At least, that was how the strong man told the story.
"Yes, of course."
Maggie looked her father's way again. Fenolio had sent him a message delivered by Battista. "You can't trust Orpheus, Mortimer. All useless."
"Don't do it, Mo, please."
"I'm looking for a name."
Doria sounded shyer than usual.
"But I can't read. It's my sister's name. What was she called?"
If the strong man was right, Doria had been 15 on the very day when the milksop was going to hang him. Maggie thought he looked older.
"Ah, well," the strong man had said. "Could be he's older. My mother's not that good at counting. She can't even remember my birthday."
"Her name was Susa."
Doria looked at the graves as if the name alone could conjure up his sister.
"My brother says she's supposed to be buried here, only he can't remember just where."
They found the gravestone. It was overgrown with ivy, but the name was still clearly legible. Doria bent down and moved the ivy leaves aside.
"She had hair as bright as yours," he said. "Lazaro says my mother turned her out because she wanted to go and live with the strolling players. He never forgave her for that."
"Lazaro?"
"My brother. You call him the strong man."
Doria traced the letters with his finger. They looked as if someone had scratched them into the stone with a knife. The first S was overgrown with moss. Mo was still talking to Orpheus. Orpheus handed him a sheet of paper, the words he had written at Risa's request. Was Mo going to read them this very night, if the white women really did appear? Would they all be back in Eleanor's house before it was day? Maggie didn't know whether the idea made her feel sad or relieved. She didn't want to think about it either. All she wanted was for Mo to get on his horse and ride away again, and for her mother's tears never to have brought him here. Farid was standing a little way off with Jink on his shoulder. At the sight of him, Meggie's heart felt the same chill as when she looked at Risa. Farid had taken Orpheus's demand to Mo, knowing what danger it could mean for her father, knowing, too, that if the deal went through, they might never see each other again. But all that meant nothing to Farid. He cared for only one person, and that was Dustfinger.
"They say you come from far away, you and the Blue Jay."
Doria had drawn the knife from his belt and was scratching the moss away from his sister's name.
"Is it different there?"
What could she say to that?
"Yes,"
she murmured at last.
"Very different." "Really? Farid says there are coaches that can drive without horses and music that comes out of a tiny black box?"
Maggie couldn't help smiling.
"Yes, that's right," she said quietly.
Doria placed the white flower on his sister's grave and stood up.
"Is it true that there are flying machines in that country too?"
How curious he was.
"I once tried making myself wings, I even flew a little way with them, but not very far.
Yes, there are flying machines there as well, replied Meggy distractedly. Risa can draw them for you.
Mo folded the sheet of paper that Orpheus had given him.
Her mother went over to him and began talking to him urgently. Why bother? He wouldn't listen to her. There's no other way, Meggy, was all he had said, when she herself had begged him not to agree to the offer made by Orpheus. Your mother is right. It's time to go back. This is getting more dangerous every day.
And what could she say to that?
The robbers had moved camp 3 times over the last few days because of the Piper's patrols, and they had heard that women were going to Umbra Castle all the time, claiming to have seen the Blue Jay in the hope of saving their children.
Oh, Mo.
They'll come to no harm, said Doria behind her. You wait and see. Even the white women love his voice.
Nonsense. Nothing but poetic nonsense.
When Meggy went over to Mo, her boots left traces in the hoarfrost, as if a ghost had been walking over the graveyard.
Mo's face was so serious.
Was he afraid?
Well, what do you think, Meggy? She asked herself. He wants to call the white women. They're made of nothing but longing, Meggy.
Farid looked awkwardly away as she passed him.
Please, you don't have to do it.
Risa's voice sounded far too loud among all the dead, and Mo gently laid his hand on her lips.
I want to, he said, and you mustn't be afraid. I know the white women better than you think.
He tucked the folded sheet of paper into her belt. There, take good care of it. If for any reason I'm unable to read it, then Meggy will do it.
If for any reason I'm unable to read it, if they kill me with their cold white hands, the way they killed Dustfinger.
Meggy opened her mouth and shut it again when Mo looked at her. She knew that look. No arguing. Forget it, Meggy.
Good. Very well, then I've done my part of the bargain. I don't think we should wait any longer.
Orpheus was visibly impatient. He was stepping from foot to foot with an unctuous smile on his lips.
They're said to like it when the moon is shining before it disappears behind the clouds.
Mo just nodded and signalled to the strong man, who gently led Risa and Meggy away from the graves to an oak growing at the side of the graveyard. At a gesture from his brother, Doria joined them under the tree. Orpheus, too, took a couple of steps back, as if it were too dangerous to stand beside Mo now. Mo exchanged a glance with the Black Prince. What had he told him? That he was going to try calling the white women only for Dustfinger's sake? Or did the prince know about the words that act would buy the Blue Jay? No, surely not. Side by side, the two of them walked among the graves. The bear trotted after them. As for Orpheus, he and his bodyguard hurried over to the oak where Meggy and Risa were standing. Only Farid stayed put as if rooted to the spot. On his face, both fear of the beings whom Mo was about to summon and longing for the man they had taken away with them. A light wind blew over the graveyard, cool as the breath of those they were waiting for, and Risa instinctively took a step forward. But the strong man drew her back.
No, he said quietly.
And Risa stood still in the shade of the branches and stared, like Meggy, at the two men who had now stopped in the middle of the graveyard.
Show yourselves, daughters of death.
Mo's voice sounded as calm as if he had called on them many times before.
You remember me, don't you? You remember Capricorn's fortress? You remember following me into the cave, and how faintly my heart beat against your white fingers? The Blue Jay wants to ask you about a friend. Where are you?
Risa put a hand to her heart. It must be beating as fast as Meggy's. The first white woman appeared right beside the gravestone where Mo was standing. She had only to reach out her arm to touch him. And she did touch him, as gently as if she were greeting a friend. The bear moaned and lowered his head. Then he retreated step by step, and did something he had never done before. He left his master's side. But the Black Prince stood his ground next to Mo, although his dark face showed fear such as Meggy had never seen on it before. Mo's face, however, gave nothing away when the pale fingers caressed his arm. A second white woman appeared to his right. She put her hand to his breast, to the place where his heart was beating. Risa cried out and took another step forward, but the strong man held her back again.
"They won't harm him. Watch," he whispered to her.
Another white woman appeared, then a fourth, and a fifth. They surrounded Mo and the Black Prince, until Meggie saw the two men only as shadows among those misty figures. They were so beautiful and so terrible. And for a moment, Meggie wished Fenolio could see them too. She knew how proud he would have been of the sight, proud of the flightless angels he had created. More and more kept coming. They seemed to form from the white vapor that Mo and the prince exhaled into the air. Why were there so many? Meggie saw the same enchantment that she felt on Risa's face too, even on Farid's, although he was so frightened of ghosts. But then the whispering began, in voices that seemed as ethereal as the pale women themselves. It grew louder and louder, and enchantment turned to fear. Mo's outline blurred, as if he were dissolving in all the whiteness. Doria looked at his brother in alarm. Risa called Mo's name. The strong man tried to hold her back once more, but she tore herself away and began to run. Meggie ran after her, plunging into the mist of translucent bodies. Faces turned to her, as pale as the stones over which she stumbled. Where was her father? She tried to push the white figures aside, but she only reached into a void again and again, until suddenly she touched the Black Prince. There he stood, his face ashen, his sword in his trembling hand, looking around him as if he had forgotten where he was. But the white women were no longer whispering. They dissolved like smoke blowing in the wind. The night seemed darker when they were gone. So dark, and so terribly cold. Risa called Mo's name again and again, and the prince looked around desperately, his useless sword in his hand. But Mo was not there. Chapter 24. To Blame. Risa waited among the graves until day began to dawn, but Mo did not come back. She felt Roxanne's pain now, except that she didn't even have a dead man to mourn. Mo was gone, as if he had never existed. The story had swallowed him up, and she was to blame. Meggie was crying. The strong man held her in his arms while tears ran down his own broad face. "It's your fault!" Meggie had kept shouting, pushing Risa and Farid away, not even letting the prince comfort her. "You two persuaded him. Why did I save him after Mortola shot him, if they were going to take him now?" "I'm so sorry. I really am so very sorry." Orpheus's voice still clung to Risa's skin like something venomously sweet. When the white women disappeared, he had stood there as if waiting for something, making an effort to hide the smile that kept returning to his lips. But Risa had seen it. Indeed she had, and so had Farid.
"What have you done?"
He had seized Orpheus by his fine clothes and hammered at the man's chest with his fists. Orpheus's bodyguard tried to grab Farid, but the strong man held him off.
"You filthy liar!" Farid had cried, sobbing. "You double-tongued snake! Why didn't you ask them anything? You were never going to ask them anything, were you? You just wanted them to take Silvertongue. Ask him. Ask him what else he wrote. He didn't just write the words he promised Silvertongue, there was a second sheet, too. He thinks, I don't know what he gets up to because I can't read, but I can count. There were two sheets, and his glass man says he was reading out loud last night."
"He's right," a voice whispered inside Risa. "Oh God, Farid is right." Orpheus, however, had taken great pains to look genuinely indignant.
"What's all this stupid talk?" he had cried. "Do you think I'm not disappointed myself? How can I help it if they took him away with them? I fulfilled my part of the bargain. I wrote exactly what Mortimer asked for. But did I get a chance to ask them about Dustfinger? No. All the same, I won't ask for my words back. I hope it's clear to all of you here," and he looked at the Black Prince, who still had his sword in his hand, "that I'm the one who gets nothing out of this deal."
The words he had written were still tucked into Risa's belt. She had been going to throw them after him when he rode away, but then she had kept them after all. The words that were to take them back, She hadn't even looked to see what they said. They had been bought at too high a price. Mo was gone, and Maggie would never forgive her. She had lost them both again for the sake of those words. Risa leaned her forehead against the gravestone beside her. It was a child's grave. A tiny shirt lay on it. "I'm so sorry." Once again, she remembered Orpheus's deep, soft voice, mingled with her daughter's sobbing. Farid was right. Orpheus was a liar. He had written what was to happen, and his voice made it come true. He had gotten rid of Mo because he was jealous of him, as Meggie had always said, and she had helped him to do it. With trembling fingers, she unfolded the paper that Mo had tucked into her belt. It was damp with dew, and Orpheus's coat of arms stood above the words, lavish as a prince's. Farid had told them how he had commissioned it from a designer of crests in Umbra. A crown for the lie that he came from a royal family, a pair of palm trees for the foreign land he claimed to come from, and a unicorn, its winding horn black with ink. Mo's own bookbinder's mark was a unicorn, too. Risa felt tears coming again. The words blurred before her eyes as she began to read them. The description of Eleanor's house was a little stilted, but Orpheus had found the right words for her homesickness and her fear that this story could make her husband into someone else. How did he know so well what went on in her heart? "From you yourself, Risa," she thought bitterly. "You took all your despair to him." She read on and stopped short. And mother and daughter went away, back to the house full of books. But the blue jay stayed, promising to follow them when the time came, and he had played his part. "I wrote exactly what Mortimer asked for," she heard Orpheus saying, his voice full of injured innocence. No, it couldn't be true. Mo had wanted to go with her and Maggie, hadn't he? "You'll never know the answer," she told herself, bent double over the little grave from the pain in her heart. She thought she heard the child inside her weeping too. "Let's go, Risa." The Black Prince was there beside her, offering her his hand. His face showed no reproach, although it was sad, very sad. Nor did he ask about the words that Orpheus had written. Perhaps he believed the Blue Jay had really been an enchanter after all. The Black Prince and the Blue Jay, the two hands of justice, one black, the other white. Now there was only the prince again. Risa took his hand and rose to her feet with difficulty. "Go? Go where?" she felt like asking. "Back to the camp, where an empty tent is waiting and your men will look at me with more hostility than ever?" Doria brought her horse. The strong man was still standing with Maggie, his big face as tear-stained as her daughter's. He avoided her eyes. So he, too, blamed her for what had happened. "Go where? Back?" Risa was still holding the sheet of paper with Orpheus's words on it. Eleanor's house. How would it feel to go back there without Mo? If Maggie would agree to read the words at all. "Eleanor, I've lost Mo. I wanted to protect him, but..." No, she didn't want to have to tell that story. There was no going back. There was nothing anymore. "Come along, Maggie." The Black Prince beckoned Maggie over. He was about to put her up with Risa on her horse, but Maggie recoiled. "No, I'll ride with Doria," she said. Doria brought his horse to her side. Farid gave the other boy a scowl when he lifted up Maggie behind him. "And why are you still here?" Maggie snapped at him. "Still hoping to see Dustfinger suddenly materialize in front of you? He won't come back any more than my father will. But I'm sure Orpheus will take you in again after all you've done for him." Farid flinched like a beaten dog at every word. Then he turned in silence and went to his donkey. He called for the marten, but Jink didn't come, and Farid rode away without him. Maggie didn't watch him go. She turned to Risa. "You needn't think I'm going back with you," she said sharply. "If you need a reader for your precious words, go to Orpheus like you did before." Again, the Black Prince didn't ask what Maggie was talking about, although Risa saw the question on his weary face. He stayed at Rhys's side as they rode the long way back. The sun claimed hill after hill for its own, but Rhysa knew that night would not end for her. It would live in her heart from now on. The same night, forever and ever. Black and white at the same time, like the women who had taken Mo away with them. Chapter 25. The End and the Beginning. They brought it all back, the memory of pain and fear, of the burning fever and their cold hands on his heart. But this time, everything was different. The white women touched Mo, and he did not fear them. They whispered the name that they thought was his, and it sounded like a welcome. Yes, they were welcoming him in their soft voices, heavy with longing, the voices he heard so often in his dreams, as if he were a friend who had been away for a long time, but had come back to them at last. There were many of them, so many. Their pale faces surrounded him like mist, and everything else disappeared beyond it. Orpheus, Rhysa, Meggie, the Black Prince, who had been standing beside him only a moment ago. Even the stars vanished, and so did the ground beneath his feet. Suddenly, he was standing on rotting leaves. Their fragrance hung sweet and heavy in the cold air. Bones lay among the leaves, pale and polished. Skulls, arm bones, and leg bones. Where was he? They've taken you away with them, Mortimer, he thought. Just as they took Dustfinger. Why didn't the idea make him afraid? He heard birds above him, many birds, and when the white women withdrew, he saw air roots overhead, hanging from a dark height like cobwebs. He was inside a tree, as hollow as an organ pipe and as tall as the castle towers of Umbra. Fungi grew from its wooden sides, casting a pale green light on the nests of birds and fairies. Mo put out his hand to the roots to see if his fingers still had any feeling in them. Yes, they did. He ran them over his face, felt his own skin, the same as ever, warm. What did that mean? Wasn't this death, after all? If not, what was it? A dream? He turned, still as if he were asleep, and saw beds of moss. Moss women slept on them, their wrinkled faces as ageless in death as in life. But on the last mossy bed lay a familiar figure, his face as still as when Mo had last seen it. Dustfinger. Roxanne had kept the promise she made in the old mine. And he will look as if he were only sleeping long after my hair is white, for I know from nettle how you go about preserving the body, even when the soul is long gone. Hesitantly, Mo approached the motionless figure. Without a word, the white women made way for him. Where are you, Mortimer? He wondered. Is this still the world of the living, even though the dead sleep here? Dustfinger did indeed look as if he were sleeping, a peaceful, dreamless sleep. Was this where Roxanne visited him? Presumably it was. But how did he himself come to be here? Because this is the friend you wanted to ask about, isn't he? The voice came from above, and when Mo looked up into the darkness, he saw a bird sitting among the web of roots, a bird with gold plumage and a red mark on its breast. It was staring down at him from a bird's round eyes, but the voice that came from its beak was the voice of a woman. Your friend is a welcome guest here. He has brought us fire, the only element that does not obey me. And my daughters would gladly bring you here too, because they love your voice. But they know that voice needs the breath of living flesh. And when I ordered them to bring you here all the same, as your penalty for binding the white book, they persuaded me to spare you, telling me you have a plan that will appease me.
And what might that be?
It was strange to hear his own voice in this place. Don't you know, even though you're ready to part with everything you love for it, you are going to bring me the man you took from me. Bring me the Adderhead, Blue Jay.
Who are you?
Mo looked at the white women. Then he looked at Dustfinger's still face. Guess. The bird ruffled up its golden feathers, and Mo saw that the mark on its breast was blood.
You are death.
Mo felt the word heavy on his tongue.
Could any word be heavier?
Yes, so they call me, although I might be called by so many other names.
The bird shook itself, and golden feathers covered the leaves at Mo's feet. They fell on his hair and shoulders, and when he looked up again, there was only the skeleton of a bird sitting among the roots.
I am the end and the beginning.
Fur sprouted from the bones. Pointed ears grew on the bare skull. A squirrel was looking down at Mo, clutching the roots with tiny paws, and the voice with which the bird had spoken now came from its little mouth.
The Great Shape Changer, that's the name I like.
The squirrel shook itself in its own turn, lost its fur, tail, and ears, and became a butterfly, a caterpillar at his feet, a big cat with a coat as dappled as the light in the wayless wood, and finally a marten that jumped onto the bed of moss where Dustfinger lay and curled up at the dead man's feet.
I am the beginning of all stories and their end, it said in the voice of the bird, in the voice of the squirrel. I am transience and renewal. Without me nothing is born, because without me nothing dies. But you have interfered with my work, Blue Jay, by binding the book that ties my hands. I was very angry with you for that. Terribly angry.
The marten bared its teeth, and Mo felt the white women coming close to him again. Was he about to die now? His chest felt tight. He was breathing with difficulty, as he had when he felt them near him before.
Yes, I was angry,
whispered the marten, and its voice was the voice of a woman, but it suddenly sounded old.
However, my daughters calmed my rage. They love your heart as much as your voice. They say it is a great heart, very great, and it would be a pity to break it now.
The marten fell silent, and suddenly the whispering that Mo had never forgotten came again. It surrounded him. It was everywhere. Be on your guard. Be on your guard, Blue Jay. Be on his guard against what? The pale faces were looking at him. They were beautiful, but they blurred as soon as he tried to see them more distinctly.
Orpheus, whispered the pale lips.
And suddenly Mo heard Orpheus's voice. Its melodious sound filled the hollow tree like a cloyingly sweet fragrance.
Hear me, master of the cold, said the poet. Hear me, master of silence. I offer you a bargain. I send you the Blue Jay, who has made mock of you. He will believe that he has only to call on your pale daughters, but I am offering him to you as the price for the Fire Dancer. Take him, and in return send Dustfinger back to the land of the living, for his tale is not yet told to its end. But the Blue Jay's story lacks only one chapter, and your white women shall write it.
So the poet wrote, and so he read, and as always his words came true. The Blue Jay, presumptuous as he was, summoned the white women, and death did not let him go again. But the Fire Dancer came back, and his story had a new beginning.
Be on your guard.
It was a few moments before Mo really understood. Then he cursed his stupidity in trusting the man who had nearly killed him once already. He desperately tried to remember the words Orpheus had written for Risa. Suppose he was trying to make an end of Meggie and Risa as well.
Remember, Mo, what else did he write? Yes, you were indeed stupid.
Death's voice mocked him.
But he was even more stupid than you. He thinks I can be bound with words. I, who rule the land where there are no words, although all words come from it. Nothing can bind me. Only the white book, because you have filled its pages with white silence. Almost daily, the man it protects sends me a poor wretch he has killed as a messenger of his mockery. I would happily melt the flesh from your bones for that. But my daughters read your heart like a book, and they assure me that you will not rest until the man whom the book protects is mine again. Is that true, Blue Jay?
The marten lay down on Dustfinger's unmoving breast.
Yes, whispered Mo.
Good. Then go back and rid the world of that book. Fill it with words before spring comes,
or winter will never end for you. And I will not only take your life for the Adderheads, but your daughter's too, because she helped you to bind the book. Do you understand, Blue Jay?
Why two? Asked Mo hoarsely. How can you ask for two lives in return for one? Take mine. That's enough.
But the Martin only stared at him.
I fix the price, it said. All you have to do is pay it.
Meggie. No, go back, Risa, Mo thought. Get Meggie to read what Orpheus wrote and go back. Anything is better than this. Go back, quickly.
But the Martin laughed, and once again it sounded like an old woman's laughter.
All stories end with me, Blue Jay. Death said, you will find me everywhere.
And as if to prove it, the Martin turned into the one-eared cat that liked to steal into Eleanor's garden to hunt her birds. The cat jumped nimbly off Dustfinger's breast and rubbed around Mo's legs.
Well, what do you say, Blue Jay? Do you accept my conditions?
And I will take not only your life for the Adderheads, but your daughters, too. Mo glanced at Dustfinger. His face looked so much more peaceful in death than it had in life. Had he met his younger daughter on the other side, and Cosimo, and Roxanne's first husband? Were all the dead in the same place? The cat sat down in front of him and stared at him.
I accept, said Mo,
so hoarsely that he could hardly make out his own words.
But I make a condition, too. Give me the fire dancer to go with me. My voice stole 10 years of his life. Let me give them back to him. And there is another thing. Don't the songs say that the Adderhead's death will come out of the fire?
The cat crouched down. Fur fell red on the rotting leaves. Bones covered themselves with flesh and feathers again, and the gold mocker, with its blood-stained breast, fluttered up to settle on Mo's shoulder.
You like to make what the songs say come true, do you? The bird whispered to him. Very well, I will give him to you. Let the fire dancer live again. But if spring comes and the Adderhead is still immortal, his heart will stop beating at the same time as yours and your daughter's.
Mo felt dizzy. He wanted to seize the bird and wring its golden neck to silence that voice, so old and pitiless, with irony in every word.
Meggie.
He almost stumbled as he went to Dustfinger's side once more. This time, the white women were reluctant to make way for him.
As you see, my daughters don't like to let him go, said the old woman's voice, even though they know he will come back.
Mo looked at the motionless body. The face was indeed so much more tranquil than it had been in life, and all of a sudden he wasn't sure whether he was really doing Dustfinger a favor by calling him back. The bird was still on his shoulder, so light in weight, so sharp of claw.
What are you waiting for? Asked Death. Call him.
And Mo obeyed.
Chapter 26. A Familiar Voice. They had gone, had left him alone with all the blue that clashed with the red of the fire, blue as the evening sky, blue as crane's bill flowers, blue as the lips of drowned men and the heart of a blaze burning with too hot a flame. Yes, sometimes it was hot in this world too. Hot and cold, light and dark, terrible and beautiful. It was everything all at once. It wasn't true that you felt nothing in the land of death. You felt and heard and smelled and saw. But your heart remained strangely calm, as if it were resting before the dance began again. Peace, was that the word? Did the guardians of this world feel it too, or did they long for something else? The pain they didn't know, the flesh they didn't dwell in. Perhaps, or perhaps not. He couldn't tell from their faces. He saw both there. Peace and longing, joy and pain, as if they knew about everything in this world and the other, just as they themselves were made of every color at once,
all the colors of the rainbow merging into white light. They told him that the land of death had other places too, darker than the one where they had brought him, and where no one stayed for long, except for him, because he called up fire for them. The white women both feared and loved fire. They warmed their pale hands at it, laughing like children when he made it dance for them. They were children, young and old at the same time, so old. They made him form trees and flowers of fire, a fiery sun and moon. But for himself, he made the fire paint faces, the faces he saw when the white women took him with them to the river where they washed the hearts of the dead. "Look into it," they whispered to him. "Look into it, then those who love you will see you in their dreams." And he leaned over the clear blue water and looked at the boy and the woman and the girl, whose names he had forgotten, and saw them smiling in their sleep. "Why don't I know their names anymore?" he asked. "Because we've washed your heart," they said. "Because we've washed it in the blue water that parts this world from the other one. It makes you forget." Yes, he supposed it did. For whenever he tried to remember, he saw nothing but the blue, cool and caressing. It was only when he called up fire and its red glow spread that the pictures came again, the same pictures that he saw in the water. But his longing for them fell asleep before it had woken fully. "What was my name?" he sometimes asked. And then they laughed. "Fire Dancer," they whispered. "That was your name, and always will be, because you'll stay with us for all eternity and never go away like all the others, away to another life." Sometimes they brought him a girl, a little girl. She stroked his face and smiled like the woman he saw in the water and the flames. "Who's that?" he asked. "She's been here and went away again," they said. "She was your daughter." Daughter. The word sounded like pain, but his heart merely remembered and did not feel it. It felt only love, nothing but love. There was nothing else anymore. Where were they? They had never before left him alone, not once since he had come here, wherever here was. He had grown so used to the pale faces, to their beauty and their soft voices. But suddenly, he heard another voice, very different from theirs. He knew it, and he knew the name it was calling. Dust Finger. He hated that voice. Or did he love it? He didn't know. He knew only one thing. It brought back everything he had forgotten, like a violent pain suddenly jolting his still heart into beating again. Hadn't that voice caused him pain once before? So much pain that it almost broke his heart? Yes, he remembered. He pressed his hands to his ears, but in the world of the dead, you don't hear with your ears alone. And the voice made its way right inside him, like fresh blood flowing into veins that had frozen long ago. "Wake up, Dustfinger," it said. "Come back. The story isn't over yet." The story. He felt the blue pushing him away. He felt firm flesh surrounding him again, and a heart beating in a chest far too small for it. "Silver Tongue," he thought. "It's Silver Tongue's voice." And suddenly all the names came back to him. Roxanne, Brianna, Farid. And the pain was back again. And time. And longing, too. Chapter 27. Lost and Back Again. It was dark when Gwyn woke Roxanne. She still didn't like the marten, but she couldn't bring herself to chase him away. She had seen him sitting on Dustfinger's shoulder too often. Sometimes she thought she still felt the warmth of his hands on Gwyn's brown coat. Since his master's death, the marten had allowed Roxanne to stroke him. He never used to let her do that before. But he also used to kill her chickens before, and now he spared them, as if that were part of their unspoken agreement, his thanks for her letting him and no other living creature follow her when she went to his master. Only Gwyn shared her secret and kept her company when she sat beside the dead man for an hour, sometimes two, losing herself in the sight of his still face. "He's back," said Gwyn's bristling coat as he jumped up on her breast. But Roxanne didn't understand.
She pushed the Martin away when she saw how dark it still was outside. But he persisted, hissing at her and scratching at the door. Of course, she thought